kid's stash of dope and pornography. Farm animals? Come on. In the master bedroom, at the back of a closet, John came across a wooden box. There was no lock on it, and when John opened it, he found a handgun. It was a Mauser HSC 380 ACP. He took it out of the box and hefted it in his hand. Pasted in the lid of the box, there was promotional material in German and English that he read with interest. The pistol was a double action, all steel, small frame automatic, with checkered walnut grips. Very cool. According to the pamphlet, the gun had open, fixed, recessed sights, a positive thumb safety, magazine safety, and an exposed hammer for additional safety. John tucked the gun in his waistband and helped himself to a box of ammunition. Maybe he'd write about a crook who carried a gun just like it. He returned the empty wooden box to the back of the shelf where he'd found it. Chances were the guy wouldn't pull the box out to check. He'd assume the gun was where he left it. Back in his garage apartment, John took a few minutes to decide where to hide the Mauser. He finally went into the bathroom and unscrewed the plumbing access panel. He wrapped the gun and ammunition in an old towel and pushed it into the gap on the right, snug against the underbelly of the tub. He returned to his desk, feeling fresh and renewed. Again, he raided his father's study, this time taking out William Faulkner's Light in August. Typing the first 10 pages taught him something about the power of language in the hands of someone utterly in control. Faulkner was extravagant, while Hemingway was spare. The stylistic differences seemed appropriate to the tale each was trying to tell. While Hemingway stripped away, Faulkner painted layer on layer using long, lavish sentences. Neither narrative voice was natural to John, but at least he was beginning to understand range and tone. John had a stack of Playboy magazines dating back to the first of the year. The girls all had perfect bodies, but they seemed brainless to him. What difference did it make how big their tits were when the girls themselves were shallow, egotistical, and self-involved? Yeah, right. Like he'd really turn one down as unworthy of him. Since he didn't have a prayer of meeting any of them in real life, he might as well enjoy the illusion of them as lush, sensual, and available. Leafing back through the January issue, he got sidetracked by a Ray Bradbury short story called The Lost City of Mars. And after that, the second part of a new Len Deighton spy novel called An Expensive Place to Die. Now he'd seen two more writers with entirely different literary effects. His first few stabs at fiction were erratic, prose that fell flat and ideas that died in half a page. The problem, as he saw it, was that he had nothing to draw on. He'd done a lot of reading, but he didn't have first-hand experience at much of anything. The only job he'd had was the unpaid babysitting he'd done for the amazing Mona. Weekends, he caddied at the club, but aside from the intelligence gleaned, it was mostly step-and-fetch-it stuff, cleaning club heads and humping golf bags uphill and down. He'd had no travel adventures, no athletic triumphs, no physical challenges to overcome. Well, the latter wasn't quite true. He'd been a fat boy, and he remembered how shitty that was. He thought it best to avoid stories about prowlers, lest he seem too well-informed. He wrote part of a short story based on a notion he had about a kid contaminated by radiation who turned into a zombie and infected his entire family before his dad shot him dead. He ran out of steam in the middle of that one because he couldn't think where to go with it. He wrote a mawkish essay about loneliness that struck him as funny when he read it the next day. Not quite what he was hoping to achieve. He wanted to write about a kid seduced by his tennis instructor, but that wasn't exactly an area of expertise. The tennis bro at the club had put her hand over his once, showing him how the face of the racket should feel on contact with the ball. But that was as close to having sex as he'd come, so to speak. The best part of writing, at least the best part of trying to write, was that it allowed him to spend time alone, tuned to the static in his head. Once in a while, a line came through, like an unexpected message from the outer limits of the universe. He recorded those isolated images and phrases, wondering if one day there might be more. At the end of the week, he didn't have much to show for his time, but he gathered up what he'd done and stuck the sheaf of papers in a file folder that he handed to Mr. Snow, who said, "Have a seat." John sat down in the front row, looking on self-consciously while Mr. Snow went through his pages. "What's this about, you plagiarized Hemingway?" "I typed a couple of chapters as warm-up. I tried Faulkner, too. You told me to bring everything, so I did." Mr. Snow rolled his eyes and read on. John watched his face, but he had no idea how his work was being received. When Mr. Snow was done, he straightened the pages, lined up the edges, put them in the folder, and handed it back. He didn't make a comment, so John was finally forced to clear his throat and say, "So, what do you think?" "As a general rule, beginning, middle, and end are nice. But at least you kept at it. Go back and try something else." "Like what? I mean, I'm really having trouble coming up with stuff." "Fancy that." John went back to work. He wrote at night, usually until 3, when he fell into bed. In the morning, he slept late. At lunchtime, he showered and dressed and headed over to Walker's house at the top of Bergstrom Hill, half a mile from his house. If he kept to the winding streets, the travel time was 5 minutes by scooter. But John found another route, skirting the ravine along its easternmost edge, putt-putting along the bridle paths that formed a warren of meandering trails. It required his crossing one two-lane road, but there was scarcely ever any traffic. Late afternoons, he'd spend 40 minutes lifting free weights in Mona's home gym, and then do a long run of 6 or 7 miles. After that, he'd shower, put on his slippers and sweats, and sit down at his desk. For most meals, he ate cold cereal or top ramen, which was all he could afford after the money he'd spent on furnishings. Meanwhile, Walker was spending his summer vacation selling dope. His parents were clueless and didn't seem to grasp the import of his frequent absences from the house or the unannounced visits from an assortment of friends whose names they were never told. In the fall, Walker would start his freshman year at UCST. He had no interest in living at home, but he didn't have the money to pay for off-campus digs. Even if he went in with 5 other guys, he'd be coming up short, dope money notwithstanding. John was in the same boat. Once Mona and the family returned, she'd make his continued residency dependent on his paying rent. Lionel would explain this was for his own good, a means of building character, not just a variation on Mona's abuse. John could see he'd have to find a job and juggle work with classes at City College. Mr. Snow had a point about avoiding the draft. Chapter 19. Wednesday afternoon, April 13th, 1988. Deborah Unruh agreed to meet me on the beach in front of the Edgewater Hotel. The spot she suggested was across from the hotel entrance, at the bottom of the concrete stairs that led down from the frontage road. It was a point she'd be passing in the course of her regular weekday walk, a loop that extended from her Montebello condominium to the wharf downtown. Avis Gent had called her on my behalf, and after the preliminary chit-chat, she'd summed up my mission as succinctly as I might have done in her place. Deborah didn't seem to require much in the way of persuasion. I arrived 15 minutes early and parked on the narrow road that ran behind the hotel. I locked my shoulder bag in the trunk of my car and took a shortcut through the property. I crossed the frontage road and trotted down the stairs. A dense fog was rolling in, spreading a thick marine layer that blotted out the offshore islands 26 miles away. The April air, mild to begin with, was changing its character. Erratic winds topped the waves, creating whitecaps in the chop. It was close to 3 o'clock by then, and I was already operating on sensory overload. I needed time to breathe, and I hoped the bracing ocean air would clear my head. My usual morning jog didn't bring me down this far. My circuit began and ended at the wharf, with its complicated history of good intentions gone wrong. Coastal Santa Teresa, despite its many assets, wasn't blessed with a natural harbor. Early trade by sea was inhibited because shipping companies, fearful of exposure to rough seas, were unwilling to risk their cargo when faced with the rocky shore. In 1872, a 1,500-foot wharf was finally constructed, allowing freighters and steamers to unload goods and passengers. Over the next 50 years, earthquakes, winter storms, and arsonists laid siege to the wharf. And while it was rebuilt time and time again, it failed to solve the problem of safe mooring for the swelling number of yachts and pleasure boats owned by its wealthy citizens and sometimes wealthier summer visitors. In the early 1920s, an informal engineering survey, which consisted of setting empty jugs and sacks of sawdust afloat at Horton Ravine Beach and watching which way they drifted, indicated that locating an artificial harbor to the west of the town would be folly, because prevailing currents would denude the beaches of sand and deposit it all directly into the proposed moorage basin, barring both ingress and egress. A $200,000 harbor bond issue was offered in support of this ill-conceived scheme, and voters approved the measure on May 4, 1927. Tons of rocks were barged from the islands and dumped just offshore, forming a 1,000-foot breakwater. Thereafter, as predicted, 775 cubic yards of sand per day shifted to the inside aspect of the barrier, creating a sandbar of sufficient mass to choke the harbor entrance. It wasn't long before the taxpayers were forced to buy a $250,000 dredge and a $127,000 tender in a perpetual effort to keep the harbor open at an annual expenditure of $100,000. The sum has grown exponentially since then with no permanent remedy in sight. All of this, by the way, of improvement. I did a few preliminary stretches, keeping an eye on the beach. 10 minutes later, I caught sight of Deborah Unruh approaching from my left. Avis Gent's description hadn't prepared me for how attractive she was. She was barefoot, and the wind had buffeted her silver hair into a choppy halo. She had to be in her late 60s, looking trim and fit in black velour pants with a matching jacket that she'd left unzipped, showing a red cotton t-shirt. Her eyes were brown, and her face was youthful, despite numerous soft lines that came into focus as she reached me. Kinsey? Hi, Deborah. I reached out and the two of us shook hands. Thanks for meeting me on such short notice. Not a problem. I'm just happy I wasn't asked to give up my afternoon walk. I usually go as far as the wharf and back, if that's doable for you. Absolutely. What's that, 4 miles round trip? Close enough. I took a minute to pull off my running shoes and socks. The socks I stuffed in my jacket pockets. I tied my shoelaces together and hung my shoes around my neck, letting them dangle and back. I wasn't crazy about the persistent bumping between my shoulder blades as we trudged through the soft sand, but it was better than walking fully shod. She was already moving toward the surf at a pace I might have found daunting if I hadn't been faithful to my jogging routine. On the ocean, waves broke a dozen yards out, and once we reached the hard pack, the water rushed forward in an icy flurry, covering our feet with foam before sliding out again. The Pacific is cold and unforgiving. You can usually spot a few hardy souls swimming in its depths, but no one had braved it that day. 2 sailboats tacked toward the islands, and a speedboat at full throttle paralleled the shoreline, keeping a parasailer aloft, attached by a tow rope scarcely visible against the pale blue sky. Hang gliding and parasailing are second and third down on my list of the 1,000 things I never want to do in life. The first is have another tetanus shot. Deborah said, I understand this whole business originated with Michael Sutton. What's the nature of your relationship? I wouldn't call it a relationship, I said. I met him for the first time a week ago when he hired me for a day's work. I sketched in the situation, starting with his appearance in my office and his story about the two pirates he'd seen in the woods. They claimed they were digging for buried treasure, but he noticed a bundle on the ground nearby. A few weeks ago, he came across a reference to the Fitzhugh kidnapping, and the penny dropped. Now, he's convinced he saw Mary Claire's body wrapped for burial. The only snag is, when the police excavated the site, they found a dead dog. According to the ID tag, his name was Ulf. She seemed taken aback. Well, that's bizarre. I can assure you he wasn't ours. I know. I drove to Puerto and talked to the man who owned him. He said he'd taken Ulf to Dr. McNally for hip dysplasia. X-rays revealed a nasty tumor instead, and the vet recommended euthanasia. Someone removed the dog's remains from a shed at the rear of the clinic and transported the body to your property where they buried him. The look she turned on me was perplexed. Pardon my skepticism, but it sounds like all of this is predicated on the notion that it was Mary Claire's body he saw. What makes you so sure? It seems like folly to operate on the idea when all you have is his word for it. Agreed. I'm not even sure we could say we had his word on it. Call it a hunch. Call it anything you like, it's still odd. If something went wrong in the course of the kidnapping and they had to dispose of her body, why would they bury her in our yard when Horton Ravine has acres of woods? I've been asking myself the same question. If we're lucky, we'll find answers. On the other hand, we may never know. There's a certain irony here somewhere. I haven't heard Michael's name in years. His parents, Kip and Annabelle, were our best friends. I looked over at her with interest. Really? Michael's parents? When was this? During the same period. We met at the country club when she was 6 months pregnant with him. They were the dearest people in the world. I lost Annabelle, Kip, and Patrick in a span of 2 years. Avis told me your husband died in a plane crash, I said. I was reluctant to bring up the subject of his death, but it seemed to me the conversation we were embarking on had better be rooted in reality. The fact that we were walking with our attention directed outward allowed a more intimate exchange than if we'd been chatting eye to eye over a cup of tea. Some days I think I'm reconciled, that I've dealt with the pain and it's over and done. Other days the grief is just as fresh as it was the first moment I heard. What were the circumstances? Rain was just starting graduate school, working toward her master's degree in social work at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. This was the fall of 1985. She and Patrick drove out in her car, with all her stuff in a 4x8 cargo trailer. His plan was to get her settled and then fly on to Atlanta for a business meeting. I'd have gone with him, but it made more sense for me to tend the home fires and let the two of them have the time together. The Midwest Express flight to Atlanta went down after takeoff. The right engine failed, and then a whole series of things went haywire. I was here in California without any intuition whatever. It's hard to realize your life can change so radically with no warning at all. When Rain phoned, she couldn't even speak. I thought it was a crank call and nearly hung up on her. I don't know how anyone gets through something like that. You do because you do, because you have no choice. I had Rain to consider. I set my own pain aside and focused on helping her. Tell me the time frame. I heard about Michael's accusations against his parents. The lawsuit settled in 1981. By then, Kip and Annabelle were crippled by the strain. Between the public outcry and the drain on their emotions, they were whipped. Let's not even talk about the thousands of dollars in legal fees it cost them. Annabelle died in the summer of 1983, and Kip, 6 months later. They must have been a mess after what put them through. You have no idea. The four of us talked about it for hours on end, and there was just no way out. Suing his therapist was the only hope of putting a stop to it. Even when it was over, the bad feelings remained. Some people were convinced he was actually abused, even after Marty Osborne as good as admitted the whole thing was her doing. The general attitude seemed to be that if Kip and Annabelle were accused, there must be a grain of truth to it. Both drank. I'm not saying they were alcoholics, but they hit the bottle pretty hard at times. Patrick and I were in much the same boat. We called it social drinking, but we were social every chance we got. When this came up, they couldn't suck down martinis fast enough, and that set tongues to wagging on top of everything else. At the club, feelings ran so high, the four of us resigned. That's how bad it got. I still run into people who refuse to make eye contact. They know Patrick and I were loyal, which apparently put us on the same dung heap as the Suttons, like we were somehow guilty by association. Diana told me Michael recanted. She shook her head in disgust. That was the last straw. I wanted to kill the little shit. Patrick and I were incensed, absolutely livid. Not that it made a whit of difference. Kip and Annabelle were both gone by then, and the damage was done. Diana says her mother drowned. Deborah gestured toward the surf. She was swimming a few hundred yards offshore when she got caught in the undertow. She must have used up all her strength trying to fight her way back. In the end, the ocean took her. She was quiet for a moment, and all I could hear was the chunking of sand under our feet as we walked. I wouldn't mind a touch of justice for Michael, some small sign he was getting back his own. I look at the lives he destroyed, and it seems unfair that he gets to enjoy the same sun that shines down on the rest of us. That may sound monstrous, but I don't care. I can understand how you feel, I said. It's not about vengeance. It's about balance, the sense that good and evil are in a state of equilibrium. At the same time, I have to admit I like the kid. I think he should be held accountable for the harm he did, but he's paid a price like everyone else. Not enough of one. She broke off impatiently. Let's change the subject. It doesn't do any good to dwell on it, she said, and then glanced over at me. You wanted information about Rain's abduction. How much did Avis tell you? Nothing. She said the story was yours, which is why she set this up. I do know you had a son, and you ended up raising his child. Rain is the good part. She's the love of my life. At the time we took custody, I was 44 years old, way past the point of parenting a newborn, but there she was. The birth itself was hard, and Shelley ended up having a C-section. She had absolutely no interest in mothering the child. Rain was a fussy baby and didn't nurse well. I suspect Shelley was suffering from postpartum depression. I wasn't entirely unsympathetic, but I was seriously concerned she'd harm the child. My worries were pointless, as it turned out. She and Greg and the boy vanished in a puff of smoke, leaving Rain behind. How old was she? 5 days. After the initial shock wore off, we realized how totally blessed we were. I still laugh when I think about all those PTA meetings, which I ran, by the way. All the other moms were in their 20s. I'd been chairing committees for years, and I couldn't help myself. They'd start floundering, and I'd take over. That was another reason we were so close to Kip and Annabelle. They had four kids underfoot, and suddenly we had one too. She smiled. Sorry to run on like this. Don't worry about it, I said. How long was it before you saw Greg and Shelley again? 4 years. June of 1967. I thought they were gone for good. I should have known better. Why did they come back? Well, it certainly wasn't for love of Rain or the two of us. Patrick's father had left $40,000 in a trust fund for Greg. He wasn't entitled to the money until he turned 30, but he wanted it right then. Patrick and I refused to knuckle under to his demands. He and Shelley were furious, and I was terrified they'd retaliate by taking Rain. Why was Greg so insistent on the money? I couldn't see the urgency myself. They told us they wanted to buy a farm so they could establish a commune. Their claim was they'd paid $1,000 down and needed the balance by the end of the month. Patrick asked to see the contract, but Greg said there wasn't one. It was a gentleman's agreement. Patrick thought it was hogwash, and so did I. Had they lived in a commune? Not that I ever heard, though by then they were full-blown hippies. Greg was calling himself Creed, and she was Destiny. Sean was Sky Dancer. The plan was to be self-sufficient, farming the land. Others would join them, at least in their fevered imaginations. They'd share the chores and pool their money, which I guess would go into an account to pay expenses. They thought Patrick should advance the funds, but he wouldn't budge. Neither of us liked Shelley anyway. She was poor white trash, arrogant, foul-mouthed. Sean was born out of wedlock, just as Rain was. When was Rain abducted? Tuesday, July 11th. There'd been a series of blow-ups, lots of screaming and yelling and hysterics. The uproar finally died down, and we thought they'd backed off. Then, suddenly, on the 6th, they disappeared. It was the same as the first time around. No note, no goodbyes, no here's where we'll be. 5 days after they decamped, Rain was kidnapped. I put the word in quotes because we knew it was them. You're saying they snatched Rain to force the issue? More like they were getting even, making us suffer because we hadn't done as they asked, she said. It wasn't a sophisticated plan, but they were stoned all the time, and that's how their minds worked. Anyway, they didn't demand the entire $40,000. They asked for $15,000, which I guess was their way of being clever. I'm sorry for all the editorializing. I should probably stick to the facts. Actually, I find it helpful to know what was going on in your mind. How did they pull it off? That was largely dumb luck. Rain was out in the backyard, playing in her sandbox. I'd given her some cookie cutters and a rolling pin. She had her bucket and a shovel, and she'd pour water on the sand, flatten it, and then cut out cookie shapes. The phone rang, some fellow taking a survey. He asked 10 or 15 questions that I answered. I wasn't much interested, but it seemed harmless enough. By the time I looked out the back door to check on her, she was gone. Later, she told me, a man came with a yellow kitten and said she could play with it at his house. Don't ask me to go through that part of it blow by blow. It was horrendous when it happened, and it's horrendous every time I think of it. Those first hours, I thought I'd die. I can't revisit the trauma. It gives me heart palpitations even now. Look at that. My hands have started to sweat. Understood, I said. I'm assuming the man on the phone wasn't Greg, or you'd have recognized his voice. I'm not sure. He'd already left, and he was gone for good, as far as I knew. I didn't expect to hear from him, so it wasn't his voice I was listening for. If it wasn't Greg on the phone, it must have been someone else involved, another guy. So it would seem. Greg certainly could have picked her up and taken her without a fuss. When did you first realize she'd been kidnapped? Another phone call came in. The same guy or someone else? He sounded the same to me. I called Patrick in L.A., and he was home 90 minutes later, breaking every speed law. I was a basket case. I didn't care who'd taken her or what it cost, as long as Rain came back to us alive.
You called the police?
Later. Not at that point.
Why?
Because the man on the phone said they'd kill her if we did.
They'd kill her, plural?
It might have been a figure of speech. Maybe they wanted us to picture a gang of thugs, who knows.
But you were convinced her life was at stake.
Let's put it this way. We weren't in a position to argue the point. I wasn't going to take the chance, and neither was Patrick. He was convinced Shelley and Greg were behind the scheme, but that didn't mean Rain was safe. We had no idea how far they'd take it. Patrick withdrew the money from 4 different banks. He managed to stall delivery while he made a quick trip to the plant to photocopy the bills. It was a time-consuming job, and he had to do it while the office staff was gone for the night. While he was about it, he marked the back of each bill with a fluorescent marker he used when he exported inventory. The bills looked fine, but the kidnappers might have been suspicious.
Were the marks visible?
Under a black light, sure. Every kid seemed to have one in those days. If my guess is right, they'd have worried about putting that many marked bills in circulation, which can't be as simple as it seems.
Couldn't they have passed the bills in small lots?
Maybe not locally, but somewhere else? Seems like Los Angeles would have been the natural choice.
Yes, but what fun would $15,000 be if it was spread out like that?
Patrick notified the local banks about the marked bills when Mary Claire was kidnapped. None of the money ever surfaced, as far as we know.
Avis referred to Rain as the practice child.
Of course. She was their rehearsal for Mary Claire. If you know anything about her disappearance, you'll recognize the... oh, what do they call it? The M.O. We didn't believe they'd harm Rain, but we were frantic they'd refuse to return her. She was ours. We'd formally adopted her, but if they absconded with her, we'd have no way of getting her back. They had no permanent address, no phone, no employment. She shrugged.
We did as we were told.
We received another call telling us where to drop the ransom.
Which was where?
Near the back entrance to the ravine. One of them kept me on the phone while Patrick drove over with the gym bag and tossed it out on the side of the road. Then he came home. The other kidnapper must have picked up the money and counted it, making sure the entire amount was there. They told us to wait an hour, and then we'd find her in the park off Little Pony Road. She was asleep on a picnic table, covered with a blanket. So they weren't entirely heartless. I don't know what would have happened if they'd realized Patrick marked the bills before we had her back in our keeping.
She'd been drugged.
Clearly. She wasn't completely out, but she was groggy. She was fine once the sedative wore off, whatever it was. She'd been properly looked after, fed well at any rate, and she was clean. We had her examined, and there was no evidence of sexual abuse.
Thank God for that.
What did she tell you about what went on?
Nothing coherent. Bits and pieces.
She was 4, not what you'd call a reliable witness. The only thing she was upset about was that she didn't get to keep the kitten. Aside from that, she wasn't traumatized. No nightmares and no psychological problems in the aftermath. We were thankful she came out of it unscathed. To Patrick's way of thinking, this was further support of his conviction that Greg and Shelley had a hand in it. If the two of them took her, wouldn't Rain have said so?
Deborah shook her head.
One of the kidnappers wore fake glasses with a big plastic nose attached, and the other dressed like Santa Claus. We'd taken her to see Santa on 2 previous occasions, so she was used to seeing him. He made her promise to be a good girl, and she was.
Here's what I don't get. If they'd already picked up the $15,000, why kidnap a second child?
I can tell you Patrick's theory. When Mary Claire was taken, the ransom demand was $25,000. Add 25 to the 15 we paid for Rain's return, and you're looking at $40,000, which is what Greg and Shelley wanted in the first place. That's hardly proof, but I can't believe the total was a coincidence.
It does seem like an odd amount. Too bad they weren't satisfied with what they got the first time around, I said. I let a short silence fall while I thought about what she'd told me. How soon after Rain's abduction was Mary Claire kidnapped? A week or so. By then, we had the house on the market, and we were looking at places in gated communities down south. The minute we heard about Mary Claire, we went to the police and told the detectives everything we knew. The FBI had been called into it by then. We gave them Greg and Shelley's names and descriptions, plus a description of the school bus along with a license plate number. None of this ever made the papers. They did put out an APB, but there was never any sign of them. Have you heard from them since? Not a peep, she said. I saw Sean when Patrick died. He spotted the obituary in the paper and drove down for the funeral. Drove down from where? Belicia, she said, mentioning a little town an hour and a half north of us. He was calling himself Sean again, using Dancer as his last name. He looked wonderful, tall and handsome. He has a shop up there where he builds furniture. He showed me photographs and the pieces are beautiful. He also does custom cabinet work. You think he'd talk to me? I don't see why not. You're welcome to use my name, or I can call him if you like. When you saw him at the funeral, did you ask about Greg and Shelley? Briefly. He told me both of them were gone. To tell you the truth, I didn't care that much. As far as I was concerned, Greg had been dead to me since the summer of 67. We parted from them on bad terms, and anything that happened to them afterward was irrelevant. Except for the business with Rain, of course. It bothered me that much of what she'd told me ran counter to my intuitions. I'm sorry to keep harping on Mary Claire, but I have trouble believing they'd resort to snatching her. That's hardcore for a pair who weren't seasoned criminals. Look, I know what you're getting at, and I agree. I can't imagine Greg doing any of this, even under Shelley's influence. But Patrick felt if they were desperate enough to take Rain, they wouldn't be all that scrupulous about trying again. We paid without hesitation. If the plan worked once, why not twice? I wonder how they fixed on Mary Claire. Did you know the Fitzhughes? To speak to. We didn't socialize with them, but we were all members of the Horton Ravine Country Club. But the Fitzhughes said they'd pay, didn't they? I mean, they agreed to the ransom the same way you did. They also notified the police, which they were told not to do. The kidnappers must have figured it out. But how? I have no idea. Maybe they sensed their luck had turned. Somehow they understood if they picked up the money, they'd be caught. So they left it where it was, I said. If they decided to forfeit the ransom, why not just hit the road? Why kill the child? I can't believe they meant to hurt her. Greg might have been stupid and greedy, but he'd never harm a child. Not even Shelley could have talked him into going that far. To be fair, I've questioned whether she was capable of anything so heinous. Patrick thought it was totally in character. As for the hole being dug on our property, whatever the intention, Greg and Shelley could have chosen the location, thinking it was safe. To my way of thinking, the similarities between Rain's abduction and Mary Claire's are too obvious to discount, I said. The one obvious difference is the introduction of a ransom note during the second kidnapping. As I understand it, when Rain was taken, the contact was strictly by phone. Deborah slowed, and I was surprised to see we'd almost reached the wharf by then. I'd been so focused on the conversation, I hadn't been aware of the walk itself. By now, the fog had fully enveloped us, and the air was so saturated with mist that my sweatshirt was damp. I could see beads of moisture in Deborah's hair, a veil of diamonds. I was quiet, running the information in a quick loop, and I found myself itchy with misgivings. Something's off. You and the Suttons were good friends. If Greg was one of the two guys digging in the woods, Michael would have recognized him. That's true. On the other hand, Greg and Shelley had their druggy pals who kept them supplied with dope. They sat out in the bus and smoked so much weed I could have gotten high myself. I realize now I should have turned them into the police, but I was still hoping the problem would go away of its own accord. Did you meet their friends?
I never laid eyes on them. They'd park around the corner and approach on foot, which allowed them to bypass the house and go straight to the cabana where the bus was parked. One of them had a motor scooter. I remember that because every time he left, I could hear it puttering down the street. I wish I could make sense of it.
You and me both, she said.
Oh, before I forget, Rain's driving up from L.A. for a few days. She took over the family business after Patrick died. I'm sure she'll be willing to tell you what she remembers. It isn't much, but you might pick up a useful tidbit.
That's great. I'll call and set something up.
Chapter 20. The 4-mile beach walk with Deborah had warmed me, but once I cooled off and my body temperature dropped, I could feel the chill in my bones. I returned to my car and pulled on my socks and running shoes. My feet were still wet and so grubby with sand that the cotton sawed against my flesh like a wood rasp. While I was out and about, I made a quick stop at the drugstore and stocked up on blank index cards. At 5 o'clock, I unlocked the studio door and let myself in. My first order of business was to strip off my damp clothes and hop in a hot shower, after which I put on my sweats and went down to the living room. For supper, I made myself a peanut butter and pickle sandwich. Recently, I'd been making an effort to upgrade my diet, which meant cutting down on the fries and quarter pounders with cheese that had been my mainstays. A peanut butter and pickle sandwich was never going to qualify as the pinnacle on the food pyramid, but it was the best I could do. I set my plate and napkin on the table at one end of the sofa, then opened a bottle of Chardonnay and poured myself a glass. I returned to the living room, a round trip of 20 feet. I found a ballpoint pen and curled up on the sofa with a quilt tucked around my legs. I opened the first packet of index cards and started taking notes. I had a lot of ground to cover, consigning everything I'd learned to note cards, one item per card, which reduced the facts to their simplest forms. It's our nature to condense and collate, bundling related elements for ease of storage in the back of our brains. Since we lack the capacity to capture every detail, we cull what we can, blocking the bits we don't like and admitting those that match our notions of what's going on. While efficient, the practice leaves us vulnerable to blind spots. Under stress, memory becomes even less reliable. Over time, we sort and discard what seems irrelevant to make room for additional incoming data. In the end, it's a wonder we remember anything at all. What we manage to preserve is subject to misinterpretation. An event might appear to be generated by the one before it, when the order is actually coincidental. Two occurrences may be linked, even when widely separated by time and place. My strategy of committing facts to cards allowed me to arrange and rearrange them, looking for the overall shape of a case. I was convinced a pattern would emerge, but I reminded myself that just because I wished a story were true didn't mean that it was. As my Aunt Jin used to say, it's like the Singer sewing machine repairman said to the housewife, Kinsey, wishing won't make it so. I confess I didn't get the point until I was in third grade and realized that so, S-E-W, and so, S-O, sounded the same but served different functions. More pertinent in my experience was another saying of hers, wish in one hand and shit in the other and see which fills up first. Sometimes a dog tag is just a dog tag, and two guys digging a hole are gathering worms in preparation for a fishing trip. I devoted most of Thursday to other business, despite my fascination with Mary Claire Fitzhugh. I had other work-related responsibilities. I'd been asked to comb public records for hidden assets and a nasty divorce. In that case, a husband was suspected of playing fast and loose with certain real property he claimed he'd never owned. I was also in the process of tracking down a witness to a hit-and-run accident, and that required a lot of knocking on doors, so I was out of the office for most of the day. I stopped by at 4 o'clock and spent the next 45 minutes transcribing my field notes to rough draft reports. I'd been so caught up in work, I hadn't noticed the message light blinking on my answering machine. I punched play. Tasha said, Hi, Kinsey. I'm down in Santa Teresa to meet with a client, and I was wondering if you'd be available later this afternoon. I have something I think will interest you. It's roughly noon now, so I'm hoping I'll hear from you. I'll be staying at the Beachcomber on Cabana until tomorrow morning. She recited the number, which I ignored. I went back to typing notes, but I'd lost my train of thought. I pressed play and listened to the message again, this time jotting down the number at her hotel. She must have known me better than I thought, because nothing is more irresistible than veiled references to a topic of interest. I couldn't imagine what she was up to, but I was willing to give her the benefit of the doubt. I dialed the number, and the switchboard put me through to her room. She was out, but a very pleasant automated woman told me that the party I was calling was not available at this time. She invited me to leave a message at the tone, and that's exactly what I did, saying, "Hi, Tasha, Kinsey here. I just got your message and I was hoping to catch you. I'm on my way home, but if you like, we could meet for a drink. Why don't you join me at Rosie's on Albanil, where we met before? The desk clerk can give you directions if you've forgotten where it is. The place still looks like a dive, so don't be put off. 5:30 works for me if it works for you. Hope to see you soon." I left the office at 5 o'clock and was home by 5:10, stripping off my clothes as I scrambled up the stairs. For someone indifferent to her kin, it's amazing how hard I work at looking good in their eyes. Since I tend to deal with only one aunt or cousin at a time, I don't want reports going back to the clan that my boots are scuffed or my hair is sticking out in all directions, as is usually the case. I showered and shampooed. I even shaved the requisite legs and armpits just in case I fell in a swoon and one or the other was exposed to view. How did I know how the evening would proceed? I stood in front of my closet, wrapped in a towel, staring at my clothes for one full minute, which was a long time given that in 10 minutes more I was expected to present myself fully dressed. I nixed the all-purpose dress. Though comfortable, the garment is looking a bit shop-worn, which is not to say I won't be wearing it for years. I considered my tweed blazer, but if I remembered correctly, I was wearing that very blazer the last time Tasha and I met. I didn't want her to think I had only the one blazer, though that was close to the truth. I pictured Diana Sutton Alvarez. As much as I disliked her, she did dress with class. What was it about her? Black tights, I thought, and quickly rooted through my sock drawer until I came up with a pair. I put on clean choners and then shimmied into the black tights and added a skirt. The fabric was wool, and the color was dark, so I figured I couldn't go wrong there. I found my tassel loafers and then struggled to find a top. I put on a white blouse and discovered a button missing. I tucked my shirt tail into the waistband of my skirt and then pulled on a hunter green crewneck sweater. The ensemble, which means a bunch of clothes all worn at once, didn't look half bad, but it needed another touch. I looked around the bedroom. I'd been using a hand-knit wool scarf along the bottom of the door to the upstairs bath, keeping out the drafts that crept through the crack where there should have been a threshold. I snatched up the scarf, shook off a few woofies, and slung it around my neck. I checked my reflection in the full-length mirror. I was, as they say, a sight for sore eyes. I grabbed my jacket, my shoulder bag, and my keys, and headed out the door. By 5:27, I was comfortably ensconced in my favorite booth at Rosie's, my gaze pinned on the door while I feigned indifference. Rosie took one look at me and knew something was up. I wasn't sure whether it was my hair, still slicked down and damp, or the blusher and mascara I'd taken such care to apply. I could feel myself squirm under her scrutiny. As she handed me a menu, her penciled-on eyebrows went up. "You having a date?" "I'm meeting my cousin Tasha," I said primly. "A cousin? Well, that's happy news. Is this the one you can't stand?" "Rosie, if you say anything of the sort to her, I'll sock you in the mouth." "Ooh, I'm loving when you talk tough. I glanced up in time to see Tasha enter. She paused in the doorway to survey the room. I waved, and she waved in return. She took a moment to peel off her coat and hang it on one of the wall-mounted hooks near the entrance. She retained the long scarf she'd worn under her coat collar and rearranged it over her sweater and skirt. She wore high heels, and I wore flats. Aside from that, the similarities in our outfits were unsettling, as were most other aspects of our personal appearances. I stood when she reached the table and we did that fake kissing thing, looking like a pair of budgies about to peck each other to death. Rosie appeared to be transfixed, the same reaction she'd had on prior occasions when she'd seen Tasha and me. Her gaze shifted from my face to Tasha's. I turned to her. "Rosie, this is my cousin Tasha. I believe the two of you met before."
"A cousin? And here I'm thinking you was an orphan."
"Not quite. My parents died, but my mother had four sisters, so I still have aunts and cousins in Lompoc."
"And a grandmother," Tasha put in. "You have a grandma?" Rosie said, feigning surprise. "Why, you don't have her down for visiting?"
"That's what I've been asking her," Tasha said, not wanting to pass up the chance to get under my skin. I refused to react. If I offered resistance, the two of them would gang up and turn on me like chow dogs. Rosie turned to Tasha.
"I'm bringing you good wine, not like your cousin drinks."
"Great, I'd appreciate that. The cuisine's Hungarian." Rosie nearly purred when she heard the word cuisine, which she took as a compliment.
"You know Hungarian dish what is carp in sour cream? Is special tonight, you be my guest."
She turned to me.
"I'm giving you some as well in honor of your friend. You lucky to have someone so close. My own sister Clotilde is died."
"I'm sorry to hear that," Tasha said.
"No big loss. She was crabby to the end. I'm getting wine now. You sit and I'm bringing right back."
"Looks like you've made a conquest," I remarked, as Rosie moved away. I took a seat again on my side of the booth, and Tasha slid in across the table from me.
"She's adorable," she said.
"That's one word for it.
She speaks English well. How long has she been in this country?"
60 years, give or take. We confined ourselves to chit-chat until Rosie returned with the wine in a dusty bottle with an actual cork. For me, she's quick with a screw-top jug, and wine so close to vinegar you could use it to clean windows. The wine she poured for Tasha was like drinking elixir from an orchard. Soft, subtle, with the fragrance of apples, pears, and honey. We let Rosie order for us, which she'd have done anyway. It was better to give her permission to be bossy and thus retain a modicum of control. She was otherwise a food dominatrix. The carp with sour cream turned out to be lovely. Maybe I'd have dinner here with Tasha more often. As is the case every time we meet, I couldn't help making a secret study of her. She looks not the way I look, but the way I think I look when I'm at my best. We have the same square teeth, the same nose, though mine has suffered a few indignities where hers has survived in its original state. My eyes are hazel where hers are dark brown, but the shape is the same. I could tell she plucked her eyebrows, and I envied both the skill and the courage. Sometimes I try, usually closing my eyes while doing so in hopes it won't hurt. Inevitably, I pull out the wrong hair, which makes my brows look patchy and incomplete. Then I have to use eyebrow pencil to fill in the blanks, which gives me the fierce demeanor of a kabuki. When we'd finished our meal and Rosie had removed the plates, Tasha reached into her tote and pulled out a bulky manila envelope. I expected her to hand it across the table to me, but she held it against her chest. "I've been sorting and cataloging Grandfather Kinsey's papers for the historical preservation group that raised the money to move the house. Grand asked me to take charge because his files are so voluminous and so disorganized. She's never had the patience to tackle them herself. She wants me to put together a chronological account of the house, when it was built, the architect, the plans, and that sort of thing. Grandfather Kinsey kept everything, and I mean everything. So, with a bit of digging, I've been able to come up with summaries of his meetings with the builder various construction proposals, invoices, and receipts, documenting the project from beginning to end. In the midst of it, I came across some letters that, by rights, belonged to Grand. I haven't told her I found them because there's no way to predict what she'd do with them. Destroy them, most likely. I thought you should see them first.
Well, you've got my attention.
I hope so, she said.
I held out my hand and took the envelope. While she watched, I unfolded the clasp, opened the package, and peered in. There were 3 or 4 sheets of letterhead stationery, and a series of letters bound together with 2 thick rubber bands. Old ones, apparently, because both snapped when I tried removing them. I did a finger walk through the envelopes, some of which were addressed to me, and some to Virginia Kinsey, my Aunt Jen. The postmarks were sorted dates in the latter half of 1955, the same year my parents were killed. Starting in June, and extending through the next 2 calendar years. One had been opened, but the rest were still sealed. Across the front of each envelope there was either an emphatic return to sender, addressee unknown, in Aunt Jin's unmistakable bold printing, or equally forceful messages delivered by way of post office rubber stamps, with a purple ink finger pointing accusingly at the return address. You'd think a federal crime had been committed from the savagery expressed. I knew what I was looking at. In one of my last conversations with Tasha, we'd argued this very point. Her mother, my Aunt Susanna, had said that the day my parents were killed, they were traveling to Lompoc in hopes of a reconciliation with my grandparents. She claimed that after they died, Grand tried for years to establish contact with me, and had finally given up. I'd assumed it was all bullshit, Aunt Susanna's attempt to put a better spin on the tale of my abandonment. Having never spoken to my grandmother, the gist of my quarrel with her was that she'd been content to let me languish, bereft of family solace and support, for the 29 years following my parents' deaths. Aunt Jin's parenting, while adequate, had been curiously deficient in matters of warmth and affection. Her remoteness might well have been something she'd learned at her mother's knee, but whatever the origin, I was affected. She taught me many valuable lessons about life, most of which still serve me, but of comfort, closeness, and nurturing, there was little. The letters were proof Grand had made an effort that Aunt Jin had rebuffed. I found myself without a word to say. I might have mustered a weak protest, but what would have been the point? I'd been wrong in my assumption. Grand wasn't to be faulted for neglect. Aunt Jin had refused her letters, thus cutting off communication. I cleared my throat. I appreciate this. Go ahead and open them if you want. I'd prefer to be alone, if it's all the same to you. Unless the letters turn out to be too personal or too painful, I'll be happy to make copies and get them back to you. Take your time. Will you tell Grand you found them?
I don't know yet.
If you return the letters, I won't have much choice. The minute Grand sees the seals are broken, she'll know the secret's out, whatever it may be. And if I don't return them? Let's put it this way. She's never going to ask. She might not even realize they were sitting in the files. Actually, there's something else that may prove more important. I stared, unable to imagine what could trump the ace she'd laid on the table the moment before. She took the envelope from my hand and pulled out a thin sheaf of letterhead stationery. She offered me the pages, which I read through rapidly. They were invoices submitted to Grand by a private investigator named Hale Brandenburg with an office address in Lompoc. The information was sketchy, no reports attached, but a cursory look at his charges suggested he'd been in her employ for more than a year. He'd billed her $4,000 and change, not a trivial amount given his rates, which were low by today's standards. Tasha said, Grandfather Kinsey was still living when this was done, so she either browbeat him into paying for it or she did this behind his back. In any case,
The work was done. I don't see any reference to what he was hired to do. It's possible the invoices became separated from his reports. Or maybe the reports were destroyed. Grand hates to lose, and she hates being thwarted. So nothing of this was leaked to the rest of us. I believed Mom when she said Grand tried to make contact, but I was startled to see the proof. I have trouble believing she'd go so far as to hire an investigator, but there it is. I'm guessing when all those letters came flying back, Hale Brandenburg was the next logical step. I said, well. I thought she was on the verge of taking my hand, but she made no move. Instead, she watched me with a sympathy I chose to ignore. She said, look, I know this is hard for you. Once you've read the letters, you might end up feeling the same alienation, but at least you'll know more than you do now. If you're like me, you'd rather deal with hard facts than speculation and fantasy. That's been my claim, I said with a pained smile. I'll leave you to it then. She turned and opened the handbag sitting on the seat beside her, looking for her wallet. I'll take care of it, I said. She hesitated. Are you sure? Of course. You brought me a gift. Let's hope that's what it is. If not, you owe me a dinner. Chapter 21. Deborah Unruh, May 1967. Deborah picked up Rain at preschool and dropped her off at a friend's house for a playdate. She had a couple of hours to kill and thought she'd give the kitchen and bathrooms a good scrub. This was midweek, and she wanted to get meals planned for the next few days so she wouldn't have to think about it once Patrick got home. He reserved the weekends for the family, the three of them going off on outings of one sort or another. Deborah liked to have all the work done, leaving the time free to play. She talked to Patrick 3 and 4 times a day, consulting about his business dealings and her household decisions, trading perspectives and advice. Rain stories charmed him, and Deborah tried to pass along the adorable moments as they occurred. Only another smitten parent would understand what constituted cute where a child was concerned. Rain was pretty and precocious, sweet-tempered, sunny. She wasn't perfect only in their eyes. Everyone else agreed she was remarkable, especially after Deborah and Patrick browbeat them into it. As she turned from Via Giuliana onto Alita Lane, she caught sight of a vehicle parked in the drive. It was Greg's yellow school bus, the paint job embellished by crude red, blue, and green peace symbols and anti-war slogans. She pulled the station wagon over to the side of the road and sat for a moment, engine running, thinking, shit. She tilted her forehead against the steering wheel, wondering if there was still time to escape. As long as they hadn't spotted her, she could turn the car around, fetch Rain from her playdate, check into a motel, and then let Patrick know where they were. She and Annabelle had talked about this at length, the possibility that the three of them would make another appearance one day. She'd been a complete wuss where Shelley was concerned. Looking back, she couldn't believe she'd allowed herself to be so mistreated. How had Shelley managed to intimidate her? Shelley was a pipsqueak, a twerp. She was half Deborah's age. Deborah knew a hell of a lot more about how the world worked than Shelley had ever dreamed. If Deborah didn't face the girl now, she was only postponing the inevitable. She took a deep breath. She had to do this, or she wouldn't be able to live with herself. She certainly wouldn't be able to face Annabelle, who'd given her strict instructions. Deborah put her foot on the accelerator and pulled away from the berm, then continued the few hundred feet to the house, where she eased into the garage. She entered the house through the door that opened into the kitchen. Of course, they'd let themselves in. Greg knew where the key was hidden, and even if she and Patrick had been clever enough to move it, he'd have found his way in. As a teenager, he'd made a point of coming and going any time he pleased, which rendered a curfew absurd. The house had been spotless when she left, less than an hour before. But Greg and Shelley had made themselves at home, unloading backpacks, sleeping bags, and duffels by the door to the dining room. This was territorial marking, like a dog pissing in each corner of the yard. She wasn't sure why they hadn't left their stuff in the bus unless they anticipated being house guests. Oh, Lord, she thought. She called, Greg?
Yo!
She crossed the kitchen and looked into the den where the three of them were sprawled, almost unrecognizable. They looked like ruffians, people who'd wandered in off the street. Greg had a scraggly beard and mustache. Patrick had never been able to grow convincing facial hair, and usually ended up looking like someone on a wanted poster. Greg had inherited the same sparse fuzz. He'd let his hair grow long, dark, and frizzy, and unkempt. She wondered if he knew how unattractive he looked. Or maybe that was the point. Shelley was sitting on the floor, leaning against the couch with her bare feet out in front of her, while she smoked a cigarette, using one of Deborah's Limoges saucers for an ashtray. She wore the familiar black turtleneck, torn black tights, and a long skirt. She'd kicked off her Birkenstocks, and those lay in the middle of the room. Her earrings were big silver hoops, and the tangled mass of dark hair, she now sported a series of small braids with beads woven into the ends. She was no longer the petite, thin creature she'd been. She had an earthy air about her, the residual weight of two pregnancies having caught up with her. Most alarming was the boy, Sean, who was 10 years old now, according to Deborah's calculations. His dark hair was shaggy, worn long enough to brush his shoulders. His cheeks were so gaunt, he looked like a young Abraham Lincoln. He had Shelley's huge hazel eyes set in darkly smudged sockets, which gave his face the solemnity of a lemur's. He was tall for his age and very thin. His flannel shirt was pale from wear, or too many runs through the washing machine. The cuffs rode above his wrists. His hands were thin, and his fingers were long and delicate. His pants hung on him. He'd found a spot in one corner of the room, and he had his nose buried in a copy of Frank Herbert's Dune. Deborah had read it 2 years before, when it first came out, and she was surprised that his skills were so proficient. Maybe Shelley's homeschooling hadn't been so bad after all. It was possible he was only hiding in the pages, pretending to read so he could observe what was going on without having to participate. He glanced at her once and then went back to his book. She wondered how much he remembered of her hostility toward him when he was a child of six. She'd eventually seen him in a kinder light, but her early disapproval had been savage and must have wounded him. She was ashamed that she'd blamed him for his behavior, when Shelley was the one who should have been held accountable. Greg crossed the room and gave her a bear hug.
Good to see you, he said. We were on our way south and thought we'd stop by. I hope you don't mind.
He was treating their arrival as a common occurrence, like they popped in every week. When Deborah put her arms around him, tentatively returning his embrace, she could feel his ribcage through the fabric of his shirt. She held herself stiffly, unaccustomed to the display of affection. She didn't reciprocate his feelings, or what he pretended to feel. He stepped back.
Whoa, what's this? Are you mad about something?
You took me by surprise. I would have appreciated a call, she said. She could have kicked herself for the stupidity of the comment. This was like coming face to face with home invaders, making nice in hopes they wouldn't slaughter you where you stood. Shelley snorted.
Yeah, sorry about that. Like we have a phone on the bus.
She hadn't said a fucking phone, but the expletive was buried in her tone. Deborah ignored her, addressing her attentions to Greg.
When did you get in?
15-20 minutes ago. Long enough to use the bathroom and take a look at what you've done. New paper and paint. Place looks great.
Thank you. I'm sorry I wasn't here when you arrived.
We figured you were out running errands. Anyway, we needed time to cool it after being on the road.
Can I fix you something to eat?
Shelley said.
Don't bother. We already looked in the fridge. What a waste.
I'm sure I have something. I went to the store yesterday and stocked up for the weekend. What were you thinking of?
Nothing that involves cruelty to animals, Shelley said.
Greg said, "We're vegans. No meat, no dairy, no eggs, no animal products of any kind."
"In that case, I guess you'll have to have your meals somewhere else. I don't know the first thing about vegan cooking."
Shelley sounded put upon. "We don't have the money to eat out. We used all our cash to pay for the trip," Greg said. "We left San Francisco this morning and drove straight through."
"Ah, is that where you've been? We had no idea you were so close."